This ad-free podcast is part of your Slate Plus membership.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Civil War, What Is It Good For? Edition. It's Wednesday, April 17th, 2024. On today's show, Civil War. It's the new feature film from Alex Garland, he of Ex Machina fame, Annihilation, the TV show Devs. It's about a not-so-distant future dystopian journey through a collapsed and war-torn America. It stars Kirsten Dunst as a benumbed but legendary war photographer. And then Jerrod Carmichael reality show. It's just what it sounds like and yet like nothing else in the universe. It stars the comedian Jerrod Carmichael, and it's an unsettling confessional regarding masculinity, friendship, fame, and coming out relatively late in life as gay. And finally, gaslighting like trauma and narcissism before it is a clinical reality that went universal in the pop consciousness. Does it still have any meaning? We discuss a provocative New Yorker piece by Leslie Jamison. But joining me first is Julia Turner, now of the Annenberg School at USC. Julia.
Hello, hello.
And Nadira Goff, of course, is a culture critic and all-around superstar for Slate.com. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, as always. Thanks for having me.
Civil War is the dystopian travelogue from writer-director Alex Garland, he of Ex Machina, Annihilation fame, various other things, Devs, the TV show. The United States is now divided into five major regional factions. The president, such as he is holed up in the White House as forces close in on him. America is a giant no-go zone through which four dedicated journalists have decided to go. What follows is a grotesque, picaresque journey through a burned-out, bombed-out America. The goal of reaching the White House and interviewing and photographing the president, played by Nick Offerman. The key figure here is a photographer named Lee, played by Dunst. She's a legendary photographer and war junkie whose only goal is getting the shot. To do that, she's learned how to compartmentalize all her feelings. She does, however, in all her work, have a single overriding message for the world. Don't do this. The film also stars Kaylee Spaney, she of Priscilla, Wagner Mora, and Stephen McKinley Henderson. In this clip, we hear aspiring photojournalist Jesse, played by Spaney, trying to convince Kirsten Dunst's Lee to let her join the group on their way to and through the front lines.
Lee, I'm sorry for jamming my way into your ride, okay? I know you're really angry about it, and I know you think I don't know shit, but...
I'm not angry about that, Jesse. I don't care what you do or... don't know.
Okay, but you are angry with me.
There is no version of this that isn't a mistake. I know, because I'm it. Joe and Sammy are it.
It's my choice.
Right. And I'll remember that when you lose your shit, or you get blown up, or shot.
All right, Julia, let me start with you. There's the conversation about the film as a film. I mean, it's, I think, expertly suspenseful and some ways an amazing success. And then there's a meta conversation about the ideology of the film, or really the kind of radical absence of ideology in the film, recognizably so. It's hard to know who's fighting whom and why exactly in this American Civil War. And people have taken Garland to task for that. What did you make of this movie?
First of all, we discussed the film Men by Alex Garland a couple of years ago. And I have not hated a film and disrespected a film as much as I hated and felt contempt for Men. That I can't remember disliking something we have consumed that much in many, many years. So I went into this having caught inklings of the idea that it's sort of vapid and politics-free and both sides-y, prepared, kind of gritting my teeth. I thought this movie was great. I thought this movie was really well made, really powerful. And I thought that the absence of a specific politics was part of the point, because it wasn't about the specific political situation that we are in America right now. It was about when political situations boil over to the point of violence and what that does to people, and how the frenzy that you have to be in as a culture and a society to get to violence is dehumanizing and causes people to dehumanize other people. And then it's also about the work that journalists do trying to document the effects of the frenzy, and about how that work is also dehumanizing, that the effort to portray how people dehumanize each other forces people themselves to become unhuman. So it was really a portrait of violence and conflict, which is an interesting subject. And the fact that you said it in America without explicitly making it pro or anti-Trump or anybody, to me, was not a problem. But I'm dying to hear what you guys thought.
I have a sort of ongoing theory about this movie, which is that your ability to not necessarily enjoy it, but to find it meaningful or revelatory in any way has maybe perhaps a direct correlation to how cynical you are. And I say that to say, as someone who is quite cynical, I think that the performances in the movie are great, and I do want to talk about them. I think the cinematography is interesting and really striking and really cool. I think the score/soundtrack mix is really great. But when it comes down to the actual message of the movie, I definitely walked away in the other Camp Julia thinking, okay, and like, I already think that we are at a point in our political climate in this country where people have a hunger for violence. And I already think that the sort of reveling in violence that the film shows, which I do think is interesting, I already think that that's there. And so the movie didn't necessarily show me anything that I didn't know or didn't expect, except for the fact that, like, Civil War sucks. It's bad. We shouldn't do it, you know? And I was just sort of thinking, well, if that's the message, then this movie is great for other technical reasons, but it doesn't actually do much for me as far as a statement is concerned or something like that.
I echo Nadira virtually word for word. Let me try to put my own original spin on it, though that'll be hard because that was really it for me. But I think I had two reactions to the film. One is that as a suspense film, it's nearly flawless. It's expertly, tightly directed. I was in the palm of the hands of the director virtually the entire time, on the edge of my seat, did not want to leave to get a drink or go to the bathroom. And it has a breathless kind of nerve jingling, jangling quality to it. Its storytelling is brilliant. I believe it comes in under 2 hours. It's just expert, old-fashioned Hollywood storytelling, beginning, middle, and an end. It puts a really remarkable, highly symbolically loaded button on it that works because it's been set up through the course of the entire film. Superbly done by Alex Garland, who, it should be said, came out of the gate really fast as a director. He was a veteran screenwriter to that point, but Ex Machina was his first writer-director. Really turned the whole world onto Oscar Isaac and was prescient about AI and kind of a brilliant genre film in and of itself. And then maybe I kind of agree with Julia that sort of squandered it by the time, you know, not insubstantially squandered it by the time of Men. This is a huge comeback. It looks to be shaping up as a commercial hit. And I like the convincing B-plot about the mentor-mentee, the older woman and the younger woman, and the place of one's own humanity in relation to a supposedly objective pursuit of journalism. I thought that was trenchant and very well done and emotionally satisfying. I had a second reaction. I wouldn't say that I was offended by its political vapidity exactly, but quite like Neera, I felt as though my first reaction was substantially neutralized by my second reaction, which is, we don't live in a both sides world. Anyone with a brain knows that. Anyone who claims that is being not only vapid, but either, you know, sort of toxic by omission or commission. There's one side that is filled with bloodlust and is actively politicizing violence and talking about civil war. Here's why I resent that in relation to this film. This film plays upon my anxiety, my neuroses, my fears, my ambivalences about that. That's why I was drawn to this film. And it's a substantial reason why we're discussing it and why it will be a hit, because it is touching a very live nerve of a very powerful id force and fear of that id force in America only, as Nadira says, to substantially neutralize it. And it both manipulates it and then attempts to isolate it as a variable and say, yeah, but we're taking that off the table. Well, that's what got me to the cinema in the first place. It's not that I want the movie to say something as equally vapid as Donald Trump bad, MAGA grotesque, MAGA fascism. We know that already, right? That's baked into our understanding. But to not expand my understanding of the very moment, the current moment that this movie is exploiting on its way to commercial triumph in some meaningful, more meaningful way than civil war is awful, journalists are heroes. You could set that movie in Yugoslavia, Greece, or sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, there are civil wars all over the world in which those same lessons can be extracted. We're not in a generic situation. We're in a highly specific one. And to make a movie about civil war in 2024 that doesn't answer to some aspect of that, to me, was weird. Not necessarily offensive. I couldn't admire the movie more, Julia, in all the ways that you say. I was gripped by it and in some respects really loved and admired it, but I couldn't help but feel like it had enlivened a nerve and then cauterized it in the same gesture, and that confused me.
Well, here's my theory of why that was not a safe choice, and it's actually a provocative choice, and I'm not sure if I'm right about it, but let me advance this and you guys can take your knives to it. I didn't read the film's lack of grounding in the political reality of the moment as some kind of, oh, everybody's crazy neutrality. But I read the fact that photojournalists and journalists generally were the protagonists of the film, and I don't think they're presented uncritically as heroes, was about how when you are in an oppositional state, your relationship to the truth becomes challenged because you're under threat. And I do think that across the political spectrum, we've seen that. I agree with you, of course, that applying both sides mentality to our current political climate does not make sense. But I do think the tendency to reach for the facts that confirm what you believe does exist across the spectrum in different ways. Not to the same degree, not with total equivalency, but it's a human tendency that is dangerous. And so I read the film as kind of being more about that and the rise of that and the people who are trying to combat that, but the fact that they are themselves in a very tenuous position. Like, it wasn't like rah, 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 journalists, they're just going to keep doing their stuff and it's totally unproblematic. It was like the people who are drawn to this work are weird, yes. Are adrenaline junkies, are have their own moral failings and their own, they have to dehumanize to portray what is lost when other people dehumanize. And that's fucked up. Like what I liked about the movie was that it was actually, Nadira, that it didn't have a message, that it was not actually trying to drive home a point. It was exploring this problem of what happens when we cauterize our own feelings and our fellow humanity, and we become capable of different kinds of violence, whether it's actual violence or the kind of violence of just numbing yourself to blood such that you just can capture it and capture it and capture it and think that that's not going to have an effect on you. And I think the arc that Kristen Dunst's character has, and we should come back to that performance, Nadira, I agree, because it's fucking incredible. And this movie coming out in April is nuts to me because I feel like she should be on the Oscar list for that. Her arc is about her reckoning with that. And, you know, as she's sort of passing the torch to this younger journalist, like, she sort of has the right instincts, but she also kind of is a wild child adrenaline junkie. And we'll see what kind of storytelling that actor, that journalist produces over time, you know?
And I think for me, that all sounds amazing. And I wanted to feel that. But I guess a part of my issue is I 100% think that the idea that your relationship to truth becomes challenged is one that we reckon with, is one that happens, is one that's dangerous, as you said. But if the movie doesn't give us a relationship to any truth, then our specific penchant towards, you know, believing something to a fault and then realizing that maybe that's not the actual case it doesn't exist. We don't get to live that experience. And we don't necessarily get to see journalists who are people who have ideas because they're women, because they're not white, because they're, you know, X, Y, and Z. They have a personal stake, right? And what's interesting to me is when journalists have to lay that down to carry out their work or to do whatever it is that they're setting out to do. But if we don't ground ourselves in everyone's beliefs and their preconceived notions, then we miss out on that really interesting, very specific experience of what happens when you find out that that's not the case, or what happens when you're forced to ignore that in order to pursue some other goal. And I think what is so interesting to me about the movie in turn is the interpersonal relationships that you guys are mentioning. I was fascinated by, what does it mean to hang it up? What does it mean to retire? When are you done? What does it mean to pass on the torch? What does it mean to be a mentor? But then also, what does it mean to be a mentee? And like, what are you responsible for? Right? And I find that to be so interesting. And maybe even more interesting than whatever the movie was trying to say or not say about war, because I can ground myself in interpersonal relationships and I can learn something new about my relationship to them through watching the movie. But I can't ground myself in whatever the movie is saying or not saying about political ideals, even if it wants to turn it on its head and tell me that I've been wrong the entire time, right? That's totally valid. That's even intriguing. But I feel like that just wasn't there. And when you have such strong performances that can carry all of that, it's just, I wanted there to be a little bit more, you know?
Yeah, like a next level. I mean, the other thing that's so interesting, and there have been, you know, lots of movies about foreign correspondents before, this sort of puts the war correspondent in America, which is the twist. Watching this movie made me think a lot of the documentary we saw a couple weeks ago for the show, 20 Days in Mariupol, which was, you know, of course, a documentary about someone who's doing war photography and who's a war correspondent in Ukraine. There's a lot of aesthetics in this film as well. There's a technique used where we will see the photograph captured sometimes after the journalist captures it. And of course, there is this synchronicity between the photojournalist and the director, right? Those are two people obsessed with the composition of the frame, right? Like the notion that a director would admire and want to replicate the work of photojournalists totally makes sense. But if you really want to think about the ethics of and the utility / futility of being a war correspondent, and you're willing to watch something grisly, I would probably tell you to watch 20 Days in Mariupol rather than this film, as well done and well crafted as it is.
And there's additionally, in terms of showing the photography in quick moments in the film, there's certain moments where it looks like you're actually looking through a viewfinder and the edges of the frame start to get blurry. And I thought that that was a really interesting technique as well, to sort of disorient or orient you in specific moments when things are happening. So yeah, there's a lot to like about this movie.
All right. It's Civil War. It's the writer-director Alex Garland's latest, shaping up to be a hit. We're not violently divided. I don't think this is going to come to civil conflict, but we're somewhat interestingly divided. Check it out. Let us know what you think. Our only item of business is to tell you about today's Slate Plus segment. It's about an essay in the Atlantic Monthly called Welcome to Kidulthood by Valerie Trapp in the April 10th Atlantic. It's about adults who have stuffed animals, blankies, or keep up some of the quote-unquote quirky conventions of childhood. The three of us will discuss the piece and our individual relationships to kidulthood comfort or transition objects. It should be a fun discussion. So if you're a Slate Plus member, of course, you can hear that extra content. But if you're not a Slate Plus member, you can sign up today at slate.com/culture plus. Gerard Carmichael is a very up-and-coming comedian. In his special Rothaniel, he came out as gay. For that special, he won an Emmy Award, and it, quote, unquote, catapulted him to a new level of fame. I'm quoting Nadira. She just wrote a wonderful piece about Carmichael and his new TV show, Gerard Carmichael Reality Show. Your piece, Nadira, as you know, is called Who did people think Gerard Carmichael is? They're definitely going to think something new now, I would say. The show's on Max, and it combines snippets of stand-up with his private life being filmed seemingly 24/7, or at least at very key and excruciating moments. It's a confessional tour de force, I think it's safe to say, either way, but it is dividing audiences. And as you say, Nadira, it takes on all sorts of touchy subjects, including love, friendship, loyalty, family, work, and his inability to craft good versions of whatever those things are as a partner, a friend, or a son. In the clip we're about to hear, it comes from the first episode in which Carmichael confesses his feelings towards his friend Tyler, the creator. Tyler proceeds to brush him off, so Carmichael finally corners him with the cameras rolling, and he wants to hash things out. Let's have a listen.
Tyler's car is pulling up.
Copy, we're rolling.
What the fuck? I tried to have an orgy and not even this many people showed up.
The reason I wanted to talk to you on camera is that I kind of felt like a distance between us. I have an idea of what it is, but what I think,
what do you
is
think
made
that
it
is?
Awkward. It's because I told you I had feelings for you and we didn't talk about it ever. That was like weird. I don't know if it was just too awkward to talk about or too, I don't know. Like, it's just like, I feel like you left me hanging out there a little bit. Like
when you said that, I think I replied with like something super mad, normal, regular, like.
You laughed and called me a stupid bitch.
I did. Yeah, I did.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I mean, this show, Nadira, yeah. You have to sort of hold a steady object and think through what you're watching. It's not unfamiliar. It's like the Seinfeld template meets the reality TV template, but already one is doing it an injustice. Hence what's so wonderful about your piece. You're really reckoning with a confusing, like at times like painfully naked confessional, really. I mean, it's almost more like Sylvia Plath or Robert Lowell's poetry than it is like reality TV or Seinfeld. Anyway, go tell me what do you make of this crazy show?
I love this show so much. And I say this as someone who has had a sort of off and on relationship with reality TV. Sometimes I love it. Sometimes I just fundamentally don't understand why people occupy their time with it. And this is such a different project or exploration or experiment because I feel like so much of reality TV is begging you to believe that it's real when it's very clearly fabricated. And this is something that feels so real because it's so raw. It's so embarrassing at times. It's painful at times, where why would you want to show this to the world? But the fact that you're choosing to show and have these intimate moments recorded on camera and then broadcast to anyone who has a Max or HBO subscription complicates that idea. You don't know if, because there's this voyeuristic intention behind even the actions that are present, you don't know if they're really, truly real. And there's something about the idea of presenting hard truths about oneself and sort of using cameras as a mirror that I find fascinating and I find to be a sort of incredible way to break the mold of reality TV, to break the mold of documentary, to break the mold of all of these different sort of visual art forms that we have in terms of telling stories that are supposed to be real. And I think the point of my piece is that it's a very natural culmination of everything that Gerard Carmichael has worked towards as a comedian. His history of comedy has always been about denigrating himself or making fun of himself or exploring things about himself. And the turn in that comes with his special Ruthaniel from 2022, the Emmy-winning special, where he comes out as gay. And it's, if you haven't seen it, it's phenomenal. It's amazing. It's one of the best things that I saw that year. And I 10 out of 10 would recommend. And there's this thing that he does where he strikes this balance between making fun of himself, but also deeply analyzing, as if the audience are his therapist, deeply analyzing his past trauma and his family and his history. And I think because of that, people, they really warmed up to him. A lot of people, that was their first exposure to Gerard Carmichael. And I think they got a different picture of who he is. And so what he presents in this show, which I think is also interesting, in addition to all the format stuff, is just he presents the idea that maybe he's actually just an asshole. Like, maybe he's really just not a good person at the end of the day. He, you know, there are, I've seen all the episodes now because I have screeners. I think as of recording, there's 3 of 8 that are currently released. And even in those first 3 episodes, he is a bad friend. He constantly cheats on his boyfriend. He, you know, he is trying to strike this balance between like encouraging his best friend's dreams of being an actress, but also kind of being an asshole about it. And you get the sense that maybe he's not really a great person. Or maybe at the very least, to be charitable, he has a lot of things he still needs to work out. And I don't think that audiences necessarily knew what to do with that. You know, they had the special. They want to be sympathetic to him because he came out and he's trying to navigate his relationship and relationships, plural, and settle into that and navigating sex and navigating love. And you want to give him grace and space and you want to identify with him. But then he does things that are very honest to himself, I would believe, that piss people off because they are angering. Like, for instance, the one thing that got him into a lot of controversy, which is making a sort of slave joke about his relationship to his white boyfriend. And Black audiences, particularly Black queer audiences, didn't like that. They did not like that at all. And my piece and the way that I feel about the show is that it shouldn't be surprising because the history of his comedy has always been about himself pushing the boundaries of like what is okay and what is not okay. And maybe, again, he's not a good person. But I feel like we don't know what to do with that as a society. And I think that that is so fascinating.
Well, it's definitely a great watch. I mean, there's a reason that people root for him, despite the fact that he's maybe not a nice person, as the show reveals, even in its early episodes. He's really compelling. He's really funny. He's really charismatic. There's a reason his career is on the rise, right? He's very, very talented and charming. And you see that on display. You know, I saw Gerard Michael reality show on Max as the title, and even the title, the sort of deadpan title that sounds like it's a kind of the working title for the show, is like a kind of a joke, right? And so I assumed that it wasn't going to be straight reality TV. It was going to be some kind of comedy art project from Gerard Carmichael, and, you know, was excited for that. And then as I was watching it, I was like, maybe is this just reality TV, but with good taste for smart people? Like, the thing I object to in the hangout reality TV, the charismatic star reality TV, is sort of less the idea of voyeuristically watching someone perform their life and more just how stupid and annoyingly those shows are made, with the kind of every possibly dramatic scene you see 3 times. You see it before the commercial break, and then you see it again, and then you see the flashback to it when the people talk to camera about how upset they were when they threw the drink at the whomever or the whatever. Like, the production of those shows sucks, and the production of this show is gorgeous. It has a really wry sense of humor. It has an incredible ear and eye for the subtlety of human interaction, for the kind of tension in a quick exchange, right? There's like a little moment where his assistant calls room service to get herself a spicy margarita and forgets to get his coffee, right? And like, you know, they don't turn it into like a 5-episode arc, but it sets the texture and the tone and the comfort, and that it reveals character. It's like a great little moment, and the show portrays it and then moves on. You know, neither makes it the Battle of Appomattox nor leaves it out on the cutting room floor. It just is incredibly skilled in its craftsmanship. And so I was like, oh, maybe that's the gag, is that it's just the Kardashians but elevated. And then as the plot lines unfurl, you begin to feel that you're in the presence of a extremely complicated and broken character who is trying to explicitly reckon with his brokenness, but is definitely midstream in that project. You know, there's a moment where he does something very rude to an old friend, And then he goes on like an apology tour. But, you know, as anybody who's been around a 12-step program knows, the purpose of the apology shouldn't be to make you feel better or to make you look better. The apology tour in episode 3 here feels like it's a little bit more focused on I'm a good person than I want to make amends, you know? So the third episode concludes with him kind of storming a friend's home and forcing the friend to be recorded while listening to a public act that is intended as an apology and essentially dragooning the friend into public acceptance of his contrition, which is so nasty. Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and, but the whole thing is so smart that I, you know, I don't have the screener, so I've just watched the ones that are out, but I think I will keep watching it because it's so smartly told that I still can't tell whether he is or is not in on the arc of that evolution. Like, that was episode 3. Maybe he's going to figure that out by episode 5 because it's moving so fast.
I can't wait to watch the rest of it. I mean, there's no way I'm not going to. It's totally riveting television for all the reasons. First of all, you know, it takes what was the very weakest aspect of Seinfeld and turns it into a true strength. I mean, Seinfeld just wasn't a funny stand-up comedian. And so the original conceit of the show of toggling back and forth between his stand-up, which draws upon his real life, and his supposed real life in the fictional world of the TV show, that's wonderful here because Gerard Carmichael is an extraordinary comic. I'm not familiar enough with the history of stand-up comedy to know how many sit-down stand-up comics there have been. But I love that he's just seated in a chair. He has such a captivating physical presence throughout the show, right? He's, for a man now in his late 30s, he's impossibly lean and really graceful in his physical presence. But on stage, on that chair, he's in a therapy session with an unremittingly pitiless therapist, which is effectively the audience. And he has this highly developed rapport with his audience, super conversational style, confessional style that seems totally spontaneous and unrehearsed. And yet he's one of those brilliant speakers. There's never an ah or an There are long pauses. He seems to think about what he's going to say very considerately. He's just supremely clever and precise in his verbal formulations. And so when the relationship with the audience becomes interactive, which seems to be nadir part of the act, or at least part of the act now, where people call him on his bullshit, it's almost an invitation to intelligently, right? You wouldn't want to be a dunderhead doing it. And in the snippets we have, they're supremely intelligent, highly targeted criticisms of him coming spontaneously from the audience that are so smart you would never call them heckling. And the way he pauses, absorbs them, and he takes the pain and physicalizes the pain of hearing them, and then comes back with a retort that's totally not embittered or retributive to the person who said the thing, acknowledging its truth, but turning it just so that it now combines with his wit and his powers of observation. He's just a supremely intelligent man. And he grew up poor and black in America, right? So he has a very interestingly different background than his, presumably, than his hyper-literate white boyfriend, who appears to me to be at the Iowa Writers Conference, or whatever. Yes. Who's and their relationship is totally captivating. What a lovely young man. That person has never been on a reality TV show. To pick up on what Julia was saying, in the history of reality TV, that human being, that quality of like precise sociological type has never been on a reality TV. He has gifted to Gerard Carmichael books that are the books that are in my house, and they're all over the house of Gerard Carmichael, who makes a joke about how he's never going to read them, but he's kind of trying to read them. I mean, there was I think one of the first shots of the boyfriend, he's holding a New York Review of books classics book imprint, and you're like, what am I watching?
No, and that's like, and it's all so known. I mean, I feel like Gerard Carmichael 100% understands.
Yeah.
That the scene where he makes his friend accept his apology publicly is itself fucked up.
Yes.
And he sort of actually can't resist it, but he also is sort of doing it because he knows it's such good entertainment. And the line between how much of this is actual therapy and how much of it is a performance of therapy that he's already like 7 light years beyond. Like, he is trolling you with that New York Review of Books cover, Steve. He put that there so you would say that.
He wins.
He wins. Smart, because I think throughout his comedy and throughout the show, as you guys are pointing to, you're never sure if what you are watching was truly just spur of the moment, something that he had to say or do, or an impulse he had, whether it's negative or positive, or whether it was meticulously planned and presented as if it was spur of the moment. And
if you told me this whole thing was scripted, I would also believe that.
But if you also told me,
and wouldn't care,
and I wouldn't care, right?
No.
And if you also told me that actually nobody in his camera crew knew what the fuck he was going to do at any second, I would also believe that.
Totally believe it too. Yes.
And I love that dichotomy. And I think when you present yourself as an unlikable character, but you are also urging people to believe you, but also kind of wink, wink, daring you not to, people do not know where to place you, what to do with that, how to feel. And I think that that reaction is almost as interesting as the show itself. And there's a quality of his work, all of his work, where it always feels like a work in progress, even if you're watching the final edited cut of the Bo Burnham directed Rathaniel Emmy Award winning special, right? It still feels kind of like a work in progress. And I think that there's so much in flux and so much that you're unsure of watching him that it's captivating, but that I almost have as much fun reading the comments of people trying to understand it on Twitter as I do watching the actual show. Like, it's such an interesting study just of humanity and relationships and celebrity.
All right, we'll leave it there. It's Jerrod Carmichael reality show. And Nadira's piece, I should say, is Who Did People Think Jerrod Carmichael Is? It's terrific. It's up on Slate. Check it out. All right, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse. Nadira, what do you have?
Steve? What about our third segment?
Yeah, third segment. What do you mean?
Well,
third segment?
Okay. Usually, as someone who is an assistant on the show, I feel like you should. Usually, you do a third segment.
Nadira, I have literally no idea what you're talking about.
I read a whole article. I prepped a whole third. What do you mean,
Nadira? This is a 2-segment show. It is, and it always has been. You're a guest on the show, and you're filling in for Dana. Now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse. Nadira, what do you have?
I hate this so much.
Oh, it's so cruel. Okay, the third segment, which in fact we do on the show, is about gaslighting, specifically, what would you call it, sort of a piece of reported criticism by the author Leslie Jamison. It's called So You Think You've Been Gaslit. It's in the New Yorker, April 1st, 2000. That's funny. April 1st, 2024. I just noticed that. Anyway, it's a fascinating piece of critical journalism exploring what this now ubiquitous term means politically, practically, morally. Many people are thinking about it, obviously, both professionally and in their own personal relationships. And it examines whether, I think in a very patient and very intelligent way, examines whether it's possible it's come to be so overused as to be useless. Let me give you a couple of quotes. She quotes someone named Abramson, who says that gaslighting is an act of grievous moral wrongdoing, which inflicts a kind of quote-unquote existential silencing. A therapist says that in her 20 years of practice, the pattern is confident, high-achieving women were being caught in demoralizing, destructive, and bewildering relationships that caused women to question their own sense of reality. Julia, let me start with you, because you're a journalist and an editor, and we've done pieces like this before, notably the Peril Segal piece on trauma, very similar piece, saying that it was an overused and therefore quickly becoming empty phrase. What do you make of it as a piece of journalism and by the concept behind it?
It's such a smart essay, and I'm so glad that Leslie Jamison wrote it. The term gaslight has been itching at me and bothering me since it became prominent a few years ago. And there have been a couple essays. There was one in The Atlantic a couple years ago that sort of explored the phenomenon in history. But what I think sets this one apart and makes it feel to me definitive and really scratched the itch of helping me understand why the overuse of the term bothers me so much is that it takes seriously that this is a real psychological phenomenon that does exist, and also is really curious about both the victims and the victimizers here, and kind of uncovers more surprising conclusions about what gaslighting is and when it tends to happen than you might expect. So the usage that she finds irritating, which is the same way that I find irritating, is that when people are experiencing the friction of disagreement, sometimes they will accuse the person who has the opposing view of gaslighting them. And it's a way of making whomever they disagree with seem pathological and wrong and sinister and creepy and malevolent in having the temerity to disagree with them. And it kind of shuts off the debate. It's a conversation ender, not a conversation starter, because if the accused gaslighter says, well, no, I'm not gaslighting you, I just think something different, the alleged gaslightee can be like, well, of course you would say that, and you're denying my reality, which is what I think it is. So that was satisfying, that it's a way of kind of cutting off disagreement and weaponizing the fact of disagreement when it's misused. What was interesting to me about when it's used properly is sort of the kind of symbiotic relationship between the gaslighter and the gaslightee, and also the conclusion that the relationship that's most susceptible to this is the parent-child relationship, in addition to certain romantic relationships. So anyway, I just had that satisfying feeling of having an itch scratched reading this essay, and I'm curious whether you guys had a similar experience.
Yeah, I thought this essay was great. I think that it touched on every aspect of how we conceive of gaslighting, as Julia was saying. And I thought that some of the quotes that the piece has are really fascinating and really interesting. There's a part sort of towards the end where Jameson interviews someone, I believe a psychiatrist, though I'm not entirely sure. And they basically say that as much as we use gaslighting or think of gaslighting as a way to assess a relationship or to assess the person who is doing the victimizing, it's also, if you find yourself in a habit of being gaslit often, it is also a useful tool to assess yourself, not necessarily in a victim blaming sense, but more so to learn what your vulnerabilities and your susceptibilities are. And I thought that that was fascinating. That's something that I hadn't necessarily thought about. I think my issue with these conversations generally, I end them sort of feeling like, okay, well, what do I do now? Like, it's a useful term in certain cases, but it is also being overused in certain cases. And like many therapeutic terms, it is vulnerable to being used against the person who is, you know, actually struggling in some sort of conversation or conflict or whatever. And it reminds me of the alleged text messages from actor Jonah Hill that were released or published to social media from his ex-girlfriend, where these text messages, whether they were truly his or not, were full of a partner using therapy speak to actually put down their partner, saying things like, well, my boundaries are that I don't like that you wear a bathing suit when you're surfing, right? Instead of a full wetsuit or whatever it is. And it's like, she's a professional surfer. I think that wearing a bathing suit isn't necessarily, it doesn't fall underneath someone's boundaries, right? But it's very clear that the person in those text messages, whether it is Jonah Hill or not, has used therapy speak to manipulate their partner. And I just think that it happens. It happened with negging. It happened with parasocial. It's happening with gaslighting. It just happens. And so I don't necessarily know what to do after I read these, even if they're very well crafted, very well thought out arguments or explorations of a word and its overusage. I don't necessarily know what to do with that information. And I think that that is kind of where I landed with this, but I do agree that the piece itself was very good.
Yeah, no, I thought it was terrific. I mean, I think that in the aftermath, especially of Me Too, at the height of Me Too and the Weinstein revelations, there was an emergency rebalancing that had to happen. And it concerned the power relations between men and women. And it, by necessity, it had to be highly gendered, right? It had to, its basis had to be identity politics in a healthy way, because the going into so many relationships between men and women, the field is so tilted in favor of men. Obviously, in the case of Weinstein, massively so, that treating it like an ordinary interpersonal relationship between two equals was nonsensical and would repeat the cycle of victimization. The problem then comes when we pretend that it alleviates what can often be a fundamentally epistemological problem, which is, you know, most relationships involve a high degree of subjectivity and feeling and lack a corresponding neutral third party or objective standard of judgment. As one of the people says in the piece, this is often people involved in romantic relationships. And it is possible, and I think what the piece points to, Julia, as you sort of indicate, is that it's possible for saying to someone, you're gaslighting me, to be the ultimate gaslight. And you're suddenly, you've gone from, if pushed too far, you go from a necessarily politicized, or I should say necessary politicization of romantic relationships and power relationships based on gender, to a sort of Henry Jamesian nightmare where the truth disappears completely into two co-equal people's feelings. I mean, think about, to make it a little more concrete, I mean, think about romantic relationships. The essence of a romantic relationship is that reality as an entirely neutral thing disappears. I mean, they're based entirely on a set of highly subjective feelings, as the piece argues quite intelligently, often rooted in one's earliest relationships with parents. And secondly, within romantic relationships, power is often radically unstable in its distribution between the two parties, and very often doesn't track race, class, and gender. I mean, it's not that it neutralizes those are never neutralized, but the idea that you can look at two people and say, because one is a man and one is a woman, because one is black and one is white, because one is fill in the blank, like one was born rich and one was born poor. The idea that power distributes in a romantic relationship based solely on those things is false. And so the idea that you can resort to that as the objective fact of the relationship, therefore this party owns the right to their subjectivity over the other person's right to subjectivity, and therefore gets to say, you are gaslighting me with authority, I think that's false. And I think that that ends up being almost completely demolished by this piece.
Well, she does talk about the fact that the pattern tends to be that the person with more social power of whatever yes. kind
oh,
has more ability to cause, actual gaslighting is when the gaslighty is caused to question their own perception of reality and no longer even understands what's true and what's not, which I think is also sort of a useful distinction from just the gaslighty being like wounded by your actions. but right. I mean, I think it's really interesting actually that the smartest essays about the overuse of trauma and overuse of gaslighting were written by Parle Segal and Leslie Jamieson. You know, Parle Segal, incredible critic of books, fiction and non. Leslie Jamieson, a novelist. Like, there's a way in which being a novel or seeking to understand the novel is sort of about trying to understand different psychologies and doing it with a goal of the empathetic understanding of the lived experience of everyone from, you know, the most worthy human on earth to the biggest monster that ever lived, you know, so that the kind of almost clinical eye that is applied in both of these essays to like what the actual emotional harm is of the clinical version of these things and how they've become slippery in their definition and discussion and our understanding of an array of personal and political dynamics is, I think, part of what distinguishes them. And then to come back to your question, Nadira, like, I don't know that the goal is for it to be actionable. To me, I think there are two different ways in which these terms can be used dangerously and badly. One of which is, of course, you are in an interpersonal relationship with someone who accuses you of gaslighting and you feel that is not what has been done, or you are in one where you are accusing someone somewhat sloppily of gaslighting and perhaps it would more widely distribute the wisdom to either avoid or understand those circumstances and not to use it lightly interpersonally. And then I think there's kind of the political use of like Trump is gaslighting America Which perhaps there's someone who wants to mount the argument that that is the specific harm that Trump has done to America. I'm not sure that that's the most useful term probably to apply to what he's done. But the other value of an essay like this is just putting a little ping in the heads of people who are thinking about the culture, that maybe that's not the most precise way to understand any particular development to which it might be applied. So I think it's like, you know, an interpretive aid, maybe.
I like that.
Is the value of the essay.
I like that. I think, and it definitely, in terms of an interpretive aid, like I was saying before, it definitely helped me think about different aspects of gaslighting. One thing that I think it sort of touched on, it got near to, but didn't fully go there, which is understandable because it goes so many places that I didn't necessarily feel like it needed to. But I always think of gaslighting in its sort of most invasive form as being structural or institutional. And I feel like when we think or talk about gaslighting, we never really talk about the fact that it can be systemic. And it's this piece almost gets there where, you know, there's a sort of entire experience of marginalized groups that have been gaslit, whether by the government or just by like the structures that be. And it kind of touches on specific instances of that, like women, you know, being underdiagnosed for endometriosis because their pain isn't taken seriously in all of these kinds of situations. And I think that that is also a sort of untapped well of discussing gaslighting as a tactical method to manipulate or to coerce or to oppress. And I like that the piece touched on it and sort of got close. But yeah, it's something that I sort of always think about when I think about gaslighting, but I find that other people really confine it to that interpersonal, expressly romantic situation, and then like not even saying anything about parents, which this article says a lot about.
Well, the piece is So You Think You've Been Gaslit. It's by Leslie Jamison. It's in the April Fool's New Yorker. All right, let's move on. All right, now is the moment in our podcast when we endorse Nadira. What do you have?
So I have a few endorsements, like always. The first two will be very quick. The first one is that I saw The Wiz, the new revival of The Wiz on Broadway, and it was really fun. It was modernized in what I think is a smart way, and my mother and I loved it. And so, yeah, so go check that out if you're in the area or if it goes on tour. My second very, very quick endorsement is I went to Costco for the first time yesterday, and that was a lot of fun. So everyone should go there.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I had never been.
Only went for the first time like 2 years ago and my mind was blown. I get that this is like Nadira and Julia Call Sky Blue, but that place is crazy.
That place is amazing. Did you eat from the food court? We should talk about this at another time when we're not recording.
Yes, okay.
But we'll keep going.
Costco is another endorsement. My actual endorsement is for Willow Smith, the musician, daughter of Will and Jada Smith, who goes mononymously by Willow. Her recent single called Big Feelings dropped, I want to say last week. It's the first single for her upcoming album Empathogen, which I believe drops on May 3rd. And Willow has just had such an interesting career thus far. She popped off of the scene with Whip My Hair when she was very, very young. I think that the experience of that song going mega viral and being really popular kind of was a bit scarring for her in the way that she immediately became a product. And so she rebelled against that. And now in her adulthood, she has had a sort of smattering level of success by releasing projects every few years that always have a very, very popular hit single that, you know, goes mega viral on TikTok or whatever it is. The most recent one was 2020's Meet Me at Our Spot, which went viral. And ever since then, she kind of, you know, she just releases songs here and there, but she's not the big name that you would think of when you think of the daughter of Will and Jada Smith. And I think what that has afforded her is the ability to be really experimental with her music and to learn different genres, to really learn the voice as an instrument and the guitar as an instrument, to work with people from all different walks of musical life. And she has arrived at what I'm excited for, which is her upcoming album, but specifically if the single Big Feelings is any indication, she has arrived at this really interesting flux of genres. It's like part jazz, part pop, part just, I guess, contemporary, whatever, you know, contemporary popular music is today. And, you know, it plays with instruments and time signature and all of these things. And her voice is used really intricately on it. And I love the single, but I'm just really excited for the entire sound of the album, for what she does in the future. And so my endorsement is just for Willow and for following her career and checking in with her every now and again to see what she's releasing, and specifically for the single Big Feelings.
Wait a Minute and Meet Me at Our Spot are two of my favorite songs. I mean, and it was exactly that, and you're just amazing. Like, why isn't this person, it's like the anti-Nepo baby or something, right? Like, not getting forced down anybody's throat, and the product is fucking amazing. It could have come, if it had come from anybody else, I almost think she'd be bigger right now. So I'm super psyched too. Julia, what do you have?
Well, speaking of places where you go and they make you mad with consumer frenzy and you buy everything you see, aka Costco, I was recently in the bookstore at Heathrow Airport, and there is nothing that will make you lose your mind like an airport bookstore with half an hour to kill. Somehow, despite being on the way home with overstuffed bags to a house full of books that we haven't read, my husband and I went on like a total shopping spree, and we're like, maybe I will read this weird book about the history of Albania. And among the books that we bought in the Heathrow bookstore, which I thought perhaps was going to prove to be a British rarity that would be hard for our listeners to find, but in fact is the product of a Los Angeles-based puzzler and available through American publishers, is Myrtle. Are you guys aware of Myrtle?
What? No.
Okay. So Myrtle is... essentially, what if you crossed an LSAT logic puzzle with a murder mystery? It's like a little daily puzzle where you get a bunch of like clues and descriptions about like, well, if, you know, character A is X and character 3 smokes cigarettes and character B has green eyes, and then here's a bunch of facts and figure out who did the murder with what where. It's like Clue plus Sudoku. And so anyway, I picked it up thinking like, oh, maybe this would be fun for the plane. And then as I was traveling with my 11-year-old boys over vacation, we started doing it. And it was just like the perfect level for that age. Fun little puzzles, like a good thing to do kind of at dinner, waiting for the food to come, you know, smartly written. You know, sometimes just the execution of a puzzle like that will either make you want to jump out a window and stab your eyes out or be tolerable company. And this one definitely is in the pleasant company category. And there are three compendiums of Myrtle. Is it compendia? Anyway, there are three books of Myrtles out there. We're about halfway through book one. The puzzles seem like they get a little bit more complicated as the book goes along, and I don't know if they reset book to book or get harder and harder. Anyway, Myrtle.
That sounds amazing.
If you're bored of Sudoku and Spelling Bee, try Myrtle. It's not a British rarity that's not available on these shores. You can just pick it up anywhere. Bookshop, bookstore. So I'm glad I schlepped at least that one home from Heathrow, and I do not yet know any more than I used to about the history of Albania.
I can't wait to try them. I love those kinds of like thinking puzzles.
Yes, and I should say these are the product of G.T. Carber, who is the LA-based mystery aficionado and puzzle maker behind Myrtle.
I'm going to check it out immediately, along with the new Willow songs. Okay, so this is a endorsement that builds on a previous endorsement, but I promise it goes someplace importantly new. Becca Rothfeld is the book critic for The Washington Post, and I was aware of her being a tremendously good daily paper critic on the order of Dwight Garner, and really admired her stuff when I read just a fabulously intricate and beautifully argued and in many ways appropriately ruthless takedown of a writer. I won't pile on and name the writer again. But, and that led me to her forthcoming book, Things Are Too Small. Actually, forthcoming. It's out. It was forthcoming when I was led to it. It's now out. Things Are Too Small by Becca Rothfeld, which I've now read most of in preparation for a segment we're going to do with Becca Rothfeld next week. That's the importantly new place. So, agenda item number one, please go out and purchase and read Becca Rothfeld's Things Are Too Small. It is so incredibly good. And secondly, let me tell you exactly why, in addition to being a homework from us. It's it's such a, I will say Macmillan's website does a really good job of summing it up, so I'm just going to quote that. A glorious call to throw off restraint and balance in favor of excess, abandon, and disproportion. And it's more than that, and they get at that as well. It really is, it's a political book in ways that I don't think I fully understood it was going to be going in, but I found myself totally convinced of and very moved by, in some sense, that it's sort of a just take on the limits of justice, and that justice has certain realms in which that should be the governing concept. And she brilliantly invokes John Rawls, who appears to be her favorite political philosopher. He's probably my favorite political philosopher as well. And then all these other realms that we've imposed justice upon, namely culture and interpersonal relationships, or at least a reductive notion of justice, in part because we're frustrated that we couldn't successfully impose it on the world of economics and politics. And so we're looking to equalize certain things in other realms where equalizing is totally antithetical to the nature of, for example, art or the way we live or where we live or how we decorate. And it's this kind of compensatory search for the kind of, equilibria of justice in, for example, our homes that leads to Maria Kondo and the cult of Maria Kondo. And anyway, she takes these subjects on one after the other. Begin just by reading the free excerpt online. A Harper's published it. I think also Macmillan's website has it. It's just brilliantly, carefully argued. I love that it brings in effortlessly Marx, Rawls, W.H. Auden, the poet Robert Haas, who no one has thought about for God knows how long. Anyway, I think the book is marvelous, and I'm going to just go ahead and use a double S word, Susan Sontag. I mean, it's kind of reminding me of the revelation of Reading Against Interpretation. I mean, just a brilliant, brilliant book that I couldn't have more respect for. And we're so excited to have her come on the show next week. So you might want to just get up to speed to make that segment more enjoyable to listen to, but you'll have an extraordinary book in your possession if you do. So Becca Rothfeld, All Things Are Too Small. Nadira, thank you so much for coming on the show. It is really, really, really fun to talk to you all the time, every time.
As always, thanks for having me, and ditto.
And Julia, a really fun show.
Yeah, great time chatting.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com. The introductory music to our show is by the wonderful Nicholas Britell. Our production assistant is Kat Hong. Our producer is Jared Downing. For Nadira Goffin, Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
Hello and welcome to the Slot Plus segment of the Slate Culture Gabfest. Today we are talking about an article in The Atlantic called Welcome to Kidulthood, about the phenomenon of adults still using or sleeping with either their childhood blankies, stuffies, lovies, or transition objects, and or just acquiring cute new stuffed toys from the likes of Jellycat and Squishmallow, terms that roll off my tongue because I am in a firm Jellycat household and beset by stuffies that my children use. It's an interesting topic. So let me start, Steve, with you. Are you now or were you ever in possession of a stuffy, lovey, or blankie?
Okay, so let me just kind of paint a picture for you. So in my new residence in Brooklyn, New York, the area, let's just put it this way, an area of the house that my daughter, who's now at college, occupies when she's home, she would call it hers. I would not call it hers. It's disputed territory. But in it, there we inherited from the previous owners these beautifully crafted, I don't know what to call them, birth beds that are like, they were like wall beds, wall bunk beds or whatever, but they're not vertical, right?
Oh, there's birth
not
one with bed an on top e, of the other. Not
yeah,
like
birth
a birthing
within,
table.
No, gotcha. Not a birthing table. No midwifery here. But it's, and they're kind of pod-like and enclosed. It's like flying ultra business class, you know? And they're facing one another, and you just look at them, and they're clearly for 8-year-old twin sisters. I am right now in one of them, and I've forgotten we were doing Kidult as our plus topic, as I forget what the plus topic is going to be every week. So I can say that it was totally, totally artless and unpremeditated. I am in a birth bed under a blankie.
Well, wait, a blankie though, like a you're talking about a throw, or you're talking about like a kid's blankie that has like that little ineffable smell to it? Like an Afghan is not.
I don't know anything about ineffable smells. I just want to go on record. Okay, never said anything about ineffable smells. And if someone says I said it, it's a lie. Okay, so, but second of all, like, I think, isn't the Planky status conferred by the user's derivation of certain kinds of creaturely comfort from it that maybe isn't quite age appropriate for a man who just had a very milestone birthday?
It's like a rhombus and a square. Like, not all Afghans are blankies, but an Afghan can be a blankie.
Squares and rectangles logic, my favorite kind of logic.
All of which is to say, like, why as a seasoned audio professional, Nadira, do I need? I mean, okay, let's not go overboard, but like, quite clearly derive a sense of safety from being under a blankie.
Well, first of all, I think it's just because blankies and plushies and things are comforting and comfortable. But I'm in a sort of unique position to talk about this because just weeks ago, I had explicitly expressed to my friend that I realized I'm in the era of just buying things I would have liked as a child. And it's not necessarily that I didn't have those things as a child, because I definitely had plushies as a child, was very into them. And I still have a few. Like, I still have my Phoenix plushie from like my Harry Potter loving days and like all that kind of thing. But I have sort of gone back to more actively interacting with them and buying more. Like, I just commissioned one of my neighbors at our Philly house when I go home. She makes crochet stuffies and plushies. And I commissioned a cow, because I'm a Highland cow, because I'm newly obsessed with cows, which is maybe a different plus segment. I don't know why that happened or when, but it happened. And so I have one of those on the way. I just bought my first plushie. It's only keychain size, but for a new K-pop group that I'm obsessed with. I recently went on a sort of tear of trying to find jelly sandals that would fit that I thought were cool. And I realized when I was talking to my friend and expressing all these things that I've just sort of entered an era of buying the things that I would have liked as a kid. And I think a part of that isn't necessarily a sort of psychological thing as much as it's just I thought being an adult meant that I wasn't allowed to like them. And so I stopped liking them, I guess, presently, but it was still latent under the surface. And then once I had my own money and lived alone, I realized I could do whatever the hell I wanted. And I was like, well, plushies are cute and cool and very comfortable to sleep with. And I love cows. So I'm just going to ask my neighbor to make me a cow plushie out of crochet or buy jelly sandals because I think that they're actually aesthetically pleasing, or show my love for a K-pop group because I think that that's fun. And it makes me feel like a part of the, you know, the fandom. And yeah, there's a part of it that I do think is self-soothing in a way. But as someone who actually did have those things, it's not like I was withheld from having them as a kid and, you know, now I'm going wild. As someone who did have them as a kid, I think it's just you have the things that comfort you, that you enjoy, and you realize when you have your own money that you can just do those things as long as it's not harming anyone. And me loving cows and wanting a plushy cow isn't harming anyone, I hope. So I'm doing it. Yeah, I don't know. It's fun.
Well, I have a theory. Actually, not on your made by a neighbor one will not harm anyone, but I do think the plushies are harming somebody. But I'll get to that. First of all, Steve, I feel you are gaslighting me by professing not to know the difference between a blankie and a blanket. Like, yes, everybody likes blankets, but that is not the subject of this. Like, being cozy under a blanket is not what we're talking about here. We're talking about like attachment objects. Like, when you have one, like, I assume you don't carry that blanket around the house and hug it up to your ear like Linus.
I don't do that. But would it change your assessment if I confessed I was wearing a little Bo Peep outfit right now?
It would change my assessment of some things, but not the blanket distinction.
Okay.
It would make me wonder which milestone birthday you just had. But so I have children who have attachment objects right now and a collection of allergy-inducing stuffies that boggles the mind. And at least one child who I think would like to be the CEO of Jellycat when he grows up. And we went on a birding adventure through Hawaii when we were there last month and encountered a nesting baby white tern, which is one of the cutest, most, like, I love birds. but I don't think birds are cute, and I cannot, they are scary, weird-ass dinosaurs that I like to look at through binocular lenses, but this Google baby white tern, and they are like fluffy, and they have beady little eyes, and they have a long bill that's kind of set way back in their head, so it looks like they're smiling, and the bill is black, but it has cobalt blue at the tip, and it's so cute, oh, and it would make a really good jelly cat. And
my
so,
God, this bird is adorable.
Yeah, right?
Okay, I just looked it up. Okay,
sorry, I considered just endorsing white terns, but it seemed a little weird, but I'm glad I've gotten to squeak it into the episode. So anyway, the specific relationship that you have to the beloved like attachment object is one thing. And then cute stuffed toys that are much more widely available now in the same way that fast fashion makes like a new sweater much more widely available and cheaper than it was when we were children is another phenomenon. And then just Afghans that you have around your house for when it is chilly is a third phenomenon that is not under discussion today, despite Steve's efforts. But like, so stuffies, I think, are everywhere. And the harm there, I think, is just all the harms of fast fashion and fast production. Like the harm is whoever's making all the stuffies, wherever it is that they're making them at whatever age they are under whatever labor conditions and economic conditions. Like, I'm sure the story of widely available stuffed animals is not like, you know, the most heroic story of our modern economy. And I remember having, when I was growing up, I had two blankies that were named Blanky and Yellowy. And they were specific little, you know, they're probably like 2x2. And I had them in my bed every night. And then I also had one stuffed animal, a bear, a polar bear from Gund, that was like big and squishy and kind of like a solitary object. You know, my childhood was full of many wonderful comforts, but it wasn't like dozens of stuffies, you know? It was like there was Bear, and my friends and I used to do a skit called Judge Bear because he was big and squishy and he would kind of sit on your head, and then whoever had the bear on the head would be Judge Bear and we would have legal proceedings. So anyway, there's some of the essays we've read about this phenomenon are like concern trolling of like, oh, are millennials and zennials not growing up because they love stuffies and whatever. And there's just a conflation of a bunch of things here. Available, beautiful objects that you think are cool and cute seem fine to populate your home with. Great to source them ethically from a home sewing neighbor, but fine, right? And then there's like, at what point do you stop sleeping with your binky? Right. And that that is a slightly different question that's getting conflated in some of the articles about this. And, you know, I don't know if you want, why not? I don't have any problem with anybody doing that. It doesn't sound like that's what anybody on this show is doing at the moment. But, you know, I don't know. The notion that we must be concerned or we must conflate the rise of jelly cat with the notion that some adults still like to sleep with something specific that they're attached to. Fine. You know, like you said, is it harming anybody? It doesn't seem like it. Seems fine. So it doesn't seem like it reveals anything about the suspended animation of our adulthood, or probably people have always done that. And we just have a culture where we talk about it.
Let me throw in one thing quickly, which is that, you know, if you've had kids, you get to re-experience these comfort objects of early childhood through them, but there's the curious moment when they reject one of them or the ritual surrounding one of them, and then you realize how much you were giving yourself the gift of childhood all over again. And I thought that was like especially true when, for me, Christmas just is watching The Grinch and the Charlie Brown Special, and my kids were like, "What the fuck?" First of all, it's on friggin' Netflix. Like, we've watched it 180 times already this year. Like when your kids start saying, "Do you grow up?" You know, and it just had it was like a song they'd heard too many times. I mean, you know, I had to wait for it literally to come around on the calendar to see it again when I was a kid, and so all of the comfort I was going to derive from it got thrown back in my face. It's not something it was something I was trying to give them, but the proportion of it that I was giving myself became suddenly very evident.
Again, a movie ritual is not a comfort object, but that does sound like a moving transition, Steve. I don't know why I'm trolling you so hard in the segment. I will. I'm like a little, you've been calling me a robot for 16 years, but I feel like maybe you don't know what a lovey is, and maybe you're the robot.
I just want to point out, I called you a robot for maybe 12 years of the show, starting 3 years in, and I gave it up 3 or 4 years ago when a listener was like, you know what, you sound kind of mean when you say that.
Oh, I appreciate it. I didn't mind. I took it as a compliment. But I will share something that is both a tip and maybe a caution, which is that when my boys were little, someone gave them loveys, like a little jelly cat animal with a little blanket attached to it. So it's kind of a combo. And they did attach to them and they like to sleep with them. And so, crafty consumers that we are, we immediately went online and bought like 6 of the little dog dogs and 6 of the little bear bears so that we would have backups and we would wash them and rotate them through. And then if everyone was accidentally left in Grand Central Terminal, we'd be fine. And that worked really well for like the first 4 to 5 years of my boy's life. And then around 4 and 5, each of those 6 dog dogs and bear bears got their own specific name and took on characters, and they became able to tell them apart. So there's like Fuzzy Butt and Honey Bear, and then it became worse because then there were 6 beloved objects that we could potentially leave in hotel sheets or something like that. So proceed with caution if you go that route. And then I will also say, with my daughter, the boys picked out one for her, Foxy, and she is very attached to. We did the same thing and bought 4 of them or something. She's very attached to her 4 original Foxys, but we're like, oh, she really likes Foxy. We should get some more. So we got like 3 more, and she rejects those Foxys because they're bigger and they don't smell the same somehow. I think just because they haven't been washed as much. So we're constantly gaslighting her by giving her the wrong Foxy and like trying to get her to accept it. And she's always like, no, this is a big fox. And she gives and she, and then I sort of feel sad for the hurt feelings of the inanimate reject Foxy. We also at one point took some stuffing out of it to try to basically we're gaslighting my daughter to accept inferior foxes. So it all comes full circle. I will own the phrase ineffable smell. I do think that the comfort of an actual lovey or object like that is kind of the snuggling up to it, and that it has like a specific feeling and smell, and it's like a sensory comfort thing. And that was definitely what my relationship was to the ones I had when I was a kid, which I do still possess. I don't sleep with them or use them, but I don't know. I didn't throw them out when the occasion came to throw out the things of my childhood that I didn't want anymore. They're like in a little, they're folded up in a shelf somewhere.
Yeah, I still think I have the ones of my like infancy as well. A part of me saving them is the hopes that I, you know, could pass them on to any future children someday. But I actually think that a part of saving them is that, and this is not necessarily directly applicable to the overall conversation of stuffed animals or what have you, but growing up is very different than now even. And I'm sure that I had it better than other younger people before me. But growing up, it was really hard for my mom to find dolls that were brown. And she really endeavored, like it was very important to her that I at least had some toys or stuffed animals or, you know, like stuffed people, I guess, or whatever it is that looked like me. And a part of me saving the ones that she found that she had is like, I think acknowledging her efforts and her work in some way. Mm-hmm. Whereas even if mm-hmm. I don't have any kids and can't pass them on or whatever, it would be a shame to get rid of them because it would be a shame to erase the hard work that she did to try and make my yeah. childhood as, you know, sort of equitable or reflective of my actual life as possible. And I never thought about that. So this is a very beautiful like revelation to have. Mm-hmm. This is why we talk about stuffed animals, you guys, because we have very important revelations about our childhood.
No, well, they represent that act of love
yeah.
of hers. And that's so beautiful. And it's funny because in some ways the comfort object is like a placeholder for the parents' love. It's like what you give the kid to hug when you're like, I'm not hugging you anymore. I'm going to go downstairs and make my new pasta recipe, mm-hmm. you know? But of course, like it was really nice and meaningful for my boys who love their loveys to pick the one that they wanted to give my daughter when she was born. I love that. I love the idea of keeping that object. That's such a beautiful story, Nadira. And I feel like, you know, the blankies that I have, which I didn't bring to college, you know, made a very concerted grown up, like, well, I'm these were in my childhood bed, but now I'm going to college and I certainly don't need them. And then when I moved to New York after college, I was like, I want to bring these to New York. I don't know. Maybe I want them. And then I either got bed bugs or got hysteria that I had bed bugs, which I think is maybe more accurate. And so I put them in a plastic bag for 20 years. But I finally opened the bed bug plastic bags that were sealed in 2006, like last year. No bed bugs yet, everyone. Don't be concerned. So anyway, they made their way out of there onto a back shelf. And they are such disgusting objects that I can never give them to any human child that I love or even don't like. But it sounds like yours would be a candidate for passing on, or you could like frame it in a shadow box or something and put it up as a memento. So anyway, here's to love blankets. I also love Afghans, and we can do a whole separate segment about throws anytime you want, Steve. And I'm so glad you're warm. And thank you so much, Slate Plus members, for supporting Slate, for listening to our show, and for valuing our work the way you do. We're grateful for you. We'll talk to you next week.